turn now to the first scheduled case, the United States versus Venturella. Mr. Handelsman.
May it please the court, Robert Handelsman and Andrew McGowan for the defendants. I have a cold today, so please bear with me. I'll do the best I can.
Don't sneeze too hard.
Right. We're glad we're some distance from you.
Argument one is a joint argument, and arguments two and three are fixes alone. The crux of argument one is whether a criminal forfeiture is limited to the counts of conviction. The answer is found in 28 U.S.C. section 2461C, which states in relevant part, and I quote, if the defendant is convicted of the offense giving rise to the forfeiture, the court shall order the forfeiture of property. If Congress wanted to make conduct not resulting in conviction subject to forfeiture, it would have said so in 2461C and would have used words other than convicted of the offense. For this reason, your opinion in Genova is an error. It is contrary to the plain language of 2461C, which limits forfeiture to the counts of conviction.
So then basically you want us to overrule all our precedent where we've repeatedly said that forfeiture can be extended to the total amount gained by the crime or the criminal scheme.
Well, as far as the government only cited several cases in its brief, and the only one which would come under this factual circumstance is Genova.
But didn't the defendants also agree to criminal forfeiture judgment in the plea?
Yes, they did, but if it's an illegal sentence, they can't agree to it. That's one of the reasons we're asking you to consider this for the first time on appeal. It's an illegal sentence. In this case, to say that forfeiture is the alter...
But let me just stop there for a minute. But this, in the... indictment in the mail fraud counts, there were multiple counts, 1 through 26, that alleged this criminal scheme to defraud multiple government agencies.
They pleaded guilty to only the first count, and it did not incorporate the other counts. They pled guilty to count one, which was for $477 and change.
I think you're reading our cases pretty narrowly.
But but the cases are dependent on the language of the statute. The cases cannot give the government more than the statute allows. And the statute is very specific. Convicted of the offense. There's only one offense they were convicted of here. Had the government charged them differently, we would have a different issue, but it didn't. It took each dollar amount and put it in a separate count. And we're bound by the language of the statute, not so much what the cases say, but what the statute says.
So basically you want us to just focus on paragraph 17 of count one, which dealt with the one check, and not focus on the other paragraphs in count one, counts 2 through 16, which allege the scheme and talk about the four victims and the total being in excess of $267,000. So you want us to, like, look at one part of the language in count
one. Whatever is in count one.
Right. And so what I'm saying, count one is not just that one $477 SSI check. Count one also includes other paragraphs, 2 through 16, which have the full amount.
Well,
that's a problem.
Yeah, we checked it. We didn't see that. Argument two, as limited by the reply brief, can be argued for the first time on appeal because there is no strategic or tactical reason for the withdrawal of this issue. The government does not dispute Bix's contention that the 25% of the $255,000 is a conclusion like the one which was criticized in Soto Piedra, nor does the government dispute the inconsistencies in the evidence regarding the insurer. Argument three criticizes one of your cases, Emerson, regardless of the theoretical differences between forfeiture and restitution. The fact of the matter is that when all is said and done, a victim has in its pocket more than its out-of-pocket loss if it can get restitution of forfeited amounts. And Singleton versus Wolf gives you discretion to consider this pure issue of law whose decision is not dependent on any fact-finding.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. As I understand it, Mr. McGowan, you're just dealing with rebuttal. Mr. Graber.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Dan Graber. I represent the United States in this matter. I was a trial attorney down below. As to the first argument by the defendants, Judge Williams, you're correct. The mail fraud count included 26 mailings, but as the Court knows, there's three elements to mail fraud. First, I had to prove that they devised or participated in a scheme to defraud. Two, that they had the intent to defraud, specific intent. And three, that they had a mailing in furtherance of that executed the scheme. Now, he's concentrating on that one mailing in paragraph 17, which is the way you allege out these mail frauds. You allege all the mailings. But you, at the beginning of the indictment, the first 12 pages, I lay out the scheme to defraud, and I lay out the four victims in this case that were defrauded, the federal, state, and local public agencies that they were taking money from. So there's just a fundamental misunderstanding by the defense in terms of how they're defining count one. And I cite in my brief the Brown decision, which talks about you're not limited by the mailings. Those don't control what the scope of the conduct is. It's the scheme to defraud that controls it. In this case, the scheme to defraud listed the whole amount. So we believe that the forfeiture is proper based on that. The second argument that counsel makes as to the restitution not being properly calculated, we make a waiver argument there, Your Honors, and we believe that's a valid waiver argument. In that case, Ms. Bix, her attorney, first filed the PSR objections and objected based on the fact that there's not reliable evidence in the record to support those calculations, both as to relevant conduct and as to restitution. Then, after the PSR writer did a PSR addendum and tied those numbers back to the specific paragraphs in the PSR, I then filed a sentencing memorandum, Your Honor, where I did the same thing, but I also included the exhibits that support those numbers that were in contention. Based on that, Defendant Bix's attorney filed a sentencing memorandum withdrawing the objections as to the evidentiary calculations. Then at sentencing in front of Judge Shabazz, the attorney for Venturella stood there and said, "We're withdrawing our objections." And then Judge Shabazz, in response, said, "Well, since I don't hear anything from Bix, I think there may be a problem here with acceptance." And the minute he said that, the attorney for Bix stood up and said, "Well, I'm withdrawing my objections, too. I don't have any problems with the numbers as to both schemes." And based on that, then we moved forward. That's a withdrawal, Your Honor. That's a waiver. And it was done for a tactical purpose. Under Jaime, the decision in this circuit that talks about defense counsel's conduct in a sentencing hearing and whether that constitutes waiver, we believe it does. And the reason we believe that that withdrawal was done, it was an affirmative withdrawal, and it was done for tactical purposes because counsel was afraid they were going to lose those 3 points for acceptance if they didn't do that. And, in fact, if you look at Judge Shabazz's comments, he basically said if you're going to deny relevant conduct, you're going to lose some points. And that's why they did it. So we believe that's a valid waiver argument and that precludes appellate review of that issue. Now, in the brief, I do get into the merits and explain how some of those numbers were calculated. Counsel talks about one of them in his argument. He briefly said when it comes to the determination of the care and maintenance payments, just so the Court knows, Paul Venturella, when his estate was created and he got the medical malpractice money, part of the deal was that he would get, well, his grandparents who were taking care of him would get money as care and maintenance payments for Paul. It started at $2,500 a month, went to $2,800, and ended up at $3,000. That was money that they were supposed to use for Paul to pay his medicals, to pay everything. They didn't do that. They didn't take any of that money and spent it on Paul. They spent it on themselves. And the reason they didn't spend it on Paul was because they had they were on public aid. And the way it was found out, the guardian ad litem went up there in June 27th of 2003 and met with the grandmother, Marge Ventarella, and said, "What's going on here? Where's this money going?" And she said, "Well, we never use that money on him. We've got Medicaid, Medicare that are paying those bills." Now, that's all in the PSR, Your Honor, and the PSR ties that back and explains why those care and maintenance payments were supported and why we believed 100% of those care and maintenance payments didn't go to Paul. And the court could have taken 100% of those care and maintenance payments and said that's a loss, that they raided his estate or his trust of that money. But in my sentencing memo, I took a very conservative approach, and I said, okay, you could take 100% of that, which would be $255,000, or you could cut it and take one-fourth of it. So I was actually giving them a break. Now, they're coming back and saying, well, that's unsupported. It's conclusions, and it's not supported by anything. If you look at my sentencing memo, which is number 59 in the record, I walk through how I did that, and the logic is this. There's four players involved in this. There's Paul, there's grandparents, his mom, or his grandparents, Joe and Marge, and then there's his birth mother, Vicky. Now, the $255,000, if you just split it by four and say, okay, Joe and Marge, maybe they thought they were getting a salary, and Vicky, maybe she thought she was getting a salary too for taking care of for Paul. Okay, argue that's a salary that shouldn't be paid up to Paul. But Paul's share should have been paid to Paul, and it wasn't. So at a minimum, as a floor, we've got one-fourth of that care and maintenance payment that should have been paid that wasn't, that they spent on themselves. So we believe the evidence more than adequately supports, or by preponderance supports, the position that that number was there and that was in the PSR and that the court properly found that it should be used for restitution. The last argument they make is the double jeopardy argument, that restitution and forfeiture are double jeopardy. That's not the case. In this court in Emerson, and they agree in their brief that they're moving a boulder up a hill because Emerson says it isn't double jeopardy and it isn't double punishment. They make a side argument that, well, okay, yeah, maybe that's not double punishments for double jeopardy purposes, but isn't there an equity argument here? Because isn't it double dipping? Because you're getting restitution from the victim, and then you're also taking forfeiture, and it's the same money, and it seems like double recovery, and that's not fair. Again, this court in Emerson dealt with that equity argument and said, no, you're looking at the victim. You got to look at the purpose and goals of forfeiture and restitution. In restitution, you're going to the victim and repaying the victim, recouping their loss. Whereas in forfeiture, you're looking at the bad guy, the actor, saying, I'm going to disgorge the ill-gotten gains from your criminal activity. And so there isn't this double recovery. And I cite in the brief Leahy, where this court actually in Leahy talks about, to the untrained eye, it may look like double dipping, but when you get beyond it and look at the focus of what these two concepts are trying to do, it isn't double dipping. You've got two different actors in this case, the victim and the defendant. If the court doesn't have any other questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you, Scriven. Mr. Handelson?
To the issue that Judge Williams raised, Mr. McGowan had a copy of the indictment. I didn't have it with me. And we don't believe that count one incorporates all the other counts. Because look at paragraph 17. It lists each count separately.
Right, but those are just the amounts. Those are the checks that are the substantive counts. What we're talking about is the actual scheme. You agree that the other paragraphs deal with the scheme to defraud.
The statute,
what it says.
Unlike restitution, the statute doesn't allow recovery from a scheme. That's where this is different. If this was written like the restitution statute, we wouldn't be here today. but it's not. In Huey, the Supreme Court said that when this dealing with a restitution statute, when it's limited to the counts of conviction, there can only be restitution for the counts of conviction. And if the forfeiture statute isn't written like the restitution statute, you have to come to the same result as Huey did. If Congress changes a statute, or if it changes statute before the sentencing, we wouldn't be here today. If the indictment alleged a conspiracy, we wouldn't be here today.
At least not on that issue.
Pardon me?
At least not on that issue.
Yes, not on that issue. But they're basically listing it as separate counts without incorporating them. As far as the $255,000 is concerned, counsel told you how he calculated. It's a guess. We don't know if it's 15%, 20%, 25%, or 30%. This is no different than the conclusion in Soto Piedra, which this court says is something that a sentence cannot be based upon. There is no double jeopardy argument for our purposes right now because cert was denied in the Bonner case. But as I mentioned in my initial argument, if you look at this as a practical matter, obtaining restitution of forfeited amounts puts more in the victim's pocket than his actual out-of-pocket loss. If I'm a plaintiff in a civil case, I would love to get forfeiture of the amount I'm suing for fraud and then get a fraud judgment. That's basically what you're talking about here. Thank you.
Mr. McGowan? All right. First of all, thanks to all counsel. And, Mr. Handelsman, as always, thank you for able representation in this case. And, Mr. McGowan, as always, thanks to the Defender Service in Peoria for its able representation.
Thank you. I always look forward to being here.
Case is taken under advisement.